This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and an all-female team of detectives to reinvestigate some astonishing crimes from the past, all of them committed by women. We're taking a look, a feminist look actually, at the crimes committed by murderesses from Britain, Australia, and North America. On the evening of the 15th of April, 1865, as the American Civil War draws to a close, President Abraham Lincoln is shot at point-blank range by the former actor John Wilkes Booth. He'd been watching a play at Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. This assassination leaves the nation stunned and horrified.
It seems as if the whole world has lost a dear personal friend.
Strong men weep in the streets. The grief is unbounded. Our lamentation will last for generations.
So how come a 42-year-old woman called Mary Surratt, a mother, widow, and deeply pious Catholic, ends up being arrested for the crime committed by John Wilkes Booth? She didn't pull the trigger, but she faces a possible death sentence.
Mrs. Surratt, when did you last see John Wilkes Booth?
I saw him at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
When did you see your son John last? And where is he?
I've not seen my son for 2 weeks. I think he's in Canada.
This is Lady Killers, where we re-examine the cases of murderesses from the past. This time, I'm exploring the story of Mary Surratt and her role in the conspiracy to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Let's find out what her story can tell us about the lives of women at the close of the American Civil War. And let's explore what happens when women step outside the domestic sphere and dare to get involved in protest and politics. Mary Surratt is brought up in a modest farming family in Maryland, a few miles from Washington, D.C. She's a fervent convert to Catholicism. Unfortunately, she makes a really terrible marriage to a dreadful alcoholic. When he dies, Mary's still in her 30s and she has a mountain of debt. But she's smart and pretty entrepreneurial. She arranges mortgages. She leases out the tavern in Maryland that she used to run with her husband. And she goes with her 2 children to DC, where she sets up a boarding house. All very admirable. But Mary Surratt is a slaveholder. She holds 8 adults and an unknown number of children on her Maryland farm. To help me explore Mary Surratt's part in Lincoln's assassination, I'm joined by a very special guest, Evie Pomperas, former NYPD officer, criminal investigator, interrogator, and a special agent with the Secret Service, where she protected no fewer than 5 US presidents. Evie, welcome to Lady Killers.
Thank you so much for having me here.
I'm very excited to talk to you. I want to know what it takes to be a Secret Service agent. I mean, do you have to literally take a bullet?
Yes, you do have to literally take a bullet. And when they put you through training, they actually put you in scenarios where you actually physically practice taking a bullet to actually make sure the bullet doesn't miss you and hit the person you're protecting.
That is absolutely amazing. Evie, if you were escorting a president to the theater today, what would that involve?
Now, you have 2 teams. You have the team that's physically with him as he moves. It's called a shift team. They're the ones that you see in the photos coming off the plane, walking next to him. The other element is called the advance team. So if he's going to the theater, well, the advance team would go a week, sometimes even 2 weeks in advance, to set up a proper security team and assessment. 90% of protection is what you do beforehand. 10% is reactive.
Yeah.
So truly, if that bullet's coming at you, that means all the layers that you put in place, they failed. And they failed badly.
I can possibly imagine that being female might allow you to bring something special to the job. Is that true?
I think it was, because I was able to, because of my appearance of not looking as a typical special agent, I would be kind of fitted into certain undercover assignments. Nobody pegged me for an agent, so it was quite easy for me.
I love this subversion of stereotypes. It's fabulous. So back to our assassination, John Wilkes Booth's plot. He plans to bump off Lincoln, and at the same time, two of Booth's associates are to assassinate the vice president and the secretary of state. And then they hope, in the chaos that will follow, to give the defeated Confederate army the chance to reignite the Civil War. Mary Surratt's 20-year-old son, John, has been working as a spy and a courier for the Confederates for some time. He becomes close friends with John Wilkes Booth, who is a famous and a charismatic young actor, and Booth starts to spend a lot of time at Mary's boarding house. Mary clearly knows that something is afoot, because she says something that sticks in the mind of one of her boarders.
After sunshine, there's always a storm. The people are too proud and licentious. God will punish them. Something is going to happen to old Abe.
I wanted to find out more about the background of President Lincoln's assassination. So I asked Dr. Nikki M. Taylor, professor of history at Howard University, to go to the scene of the crime, Ford's Theatre in the centre of Washington, D.C. And there Nikki met the education programs manager, Alex Wood.
I'm sitting here in this beautiful theater.
Yeah, so the theater has been recreated to look almost exactly as it did for Abraham Lincoln on the night of April 14th, 1865. So Abraham Lincoln wanting to come to the theater and participate in this sort of joyful release as the war was coming to an end and the city was literally partying all night long, all week long. And one of the things that's just so hard for us to imagine in this day and age is that there was really no security for President Lincoln.
Yeah.
So John Wilkes Booth is not sneaking in. He literally just walks in, no questions asked. John Wilkes Booth steps right in behind President Lincoln, shoots him in the back of the head with a single shot. He leaps out over the front of the box, kind of getting tangled in the flags on his way out. He lands hard on the stage, maybe breaking his leg here. Broken leg or no, he can't stop. He runs out the back door, sort of slashing at anyone that might dare to be in his path. And he jumps on his horse and then gallops off into the night.
Wow. And naturally, the assassination of a U.S. president sent shockwaves across the United States, particularly for African Americans who had made so many gains under his administration. And they were right there on the dawn of freedom. What did his death symbolize to them?
It was a real blow. Abraham Lincoln had made it clear in speech after speech that Union victory and the end of slavery were intertwined, and one could not be had without the other. And so he really was this heroic figure in the fight toward the abolition of slavery in the United States.
For so many African Americans, well into the 20th century, there was a picture of Jesus and Lincoln side by side. This was the tail end of the Civil War. 11 Southern states formed the Confederate States of America. They went to war against the U.S. government over the issue of slavery. But basically, by 1865, the thread of the Confederacy had kind of been undone. But there were at least two people, Alex, that were not as excited about the celebrations in this area. The first being John Wilkes Booth, and then the second, Mary Surratt, who is a slaveholder. Neither of them could really stomach the idea that the South had lost the war, and they were also perhaps fearful of all the radical social changes that were going to be brought with it, including, you know, possibly the suffrage of African Americans.
Oh, yeah.
So one last thing I want to ask you. There was another group that was also almost as affected by the changes that the Civil War wrought, and that was American women, particularly white women. And we see that the Civil War, even through the lens of the life of somebody like Mary Surratt, the Civil War afforded them opportunities that they had never been had before. Mm-hmm. They moved from the domestic sphere and were thrust into the public sphere. They were becoming more and more vocal.
Yeah, so I think when all the men went off to war, that left work to be done, that women had the opportunity to step in and fill. And that empowered women who chose to take advantage of that situation.
On the night of Lincoln's assassination, one of the first places that the police search is the Washington boarding house of Mary Surratt. They arrive at 2:30 in the morning looking for John Wilkes Booth and for Mary's son, John Surratt.
Mrs. Surratt, when did you last see John Wilkes Booth?
I saw him at 2:00 this afternoon.
When did you see your son, John, last? And where is he?
I've not seen my son for 2 weeks. I think he's in Canada. I received a letter from him on the 14th of March, postmarked in Montreal on the 12th.
Where is this letter?
I cannot find it. There are a great many mothers who have no idea where their sons are.
John Wilkes Booth is still on the run. But Mary Surratt, her daughter Anna, a friend of Anna's called Nora Fitzpatrick, and seven other suspected male conspirators are arrested. They're taken to the Old Capitol prison to be questioned by Colonel Henry Wells. Now, Mary doesn't come over at all well in this questioning. She is evasive about the whereabouts of her son John. She pretends to misunderstand the questions. She denies knowing several of the other conspirators, even though they have often been at her boarding house. Wells gets almost nothing out of Mary, but her obfuscation confirms his suspicion that she is deeply implicated in this. Evie, let's come to you. If Mary Surratt were in front of you in this situation in the interrogation room, how would you proceed?
Well, it's interesting because what Mary Surratt is doing is lying in the way that most people lie. And most people lie through omission. I don't know, I don't recall, I don't remember. So right away, your red flags go up. I am focused on getting her to a place and where she feels comfortable and relaxed, where she can speak.
I can imagine in Mary Surratt's situation, the pressure was on. You know, the president is dead. Results are going to be wanted.
You can't get quick results. If you want results, you need to slow down. You don't go in for the kill. You want to start at the periphery, the outside. Tell me about this relationship. How long have you been here? What's going on here? This is how you get people comfortable to begin just talking. You just want her to talk. As long as she's talking, I'm happy. And it may not happen in one sitting. Maybe Mary is someone I want to bring back and talk to her again, and then again, and again. This is where patience comes in. But a lot of interviewers and interrogators, they go right in for it. And what do people do? They shut down, they clam up, and they give us nothing.
Interesting. Now, back to the story. After her interrogation, Mary is transferred to the Arsenal prison. It's really filthy. There are rats and bed bugs and cockroaches and almost inedible food. Meanwhile, the law is closing in on John Wilkes Booth. On the 26th of April, he is tracked to a barn where he's holed up with a broken leg. He refuses to surrender. He gets shot. And a few hours later, he dies. Mary Surratt and the seven other male suspects are charged with the murder of Abraham Lincoln and with attempting to kill the Secretary of State and the Vice President. But Mary is singled out for some extra charges.
In further prosecution of said conspiracy, Mary E. Surratt at Washington City did receive, entertain, harbor and conceal, aid and assist John Wilkes Booth and his confederates.
All eight of the accused plead not guilty. Now, very controversially, Mary and her co-conspirators are tried by a military tribunal. That's a board of military officers, rather than a civilian judge and jury. Military tribunals usually only try members of the armed forces, but the government thinks that Lincoln's assassination is an act of war to advance the Confederate cause. Mary's daughter Anna and Anna's friend Nora are released from prison, but not before Nora confesses to the interrogators that yes, John Wilkes Booth and several other of the conspirators had indeed been frequent visitors to Mary's boarding house. But the most crucial evidence against her comes from the tenant of her tavern in Maryland. After a brutal interrogation, he not only confirms that John Wilkes Booth fled to the tavern straight after the assassination, but also that Mary had delivered a package for Booth earlier that day, and that she'd allowed the conspirators' guns to be hidden at the tavern. It's not looking at all good for Mary Surratt. Now, this trial was held in a mood of national outrage. A lot of people were desperate to avenge Lincoln's death. Evie, you were a first responder for the US Secret Service at the World Trade Center on September the 11th, 2001. And you were honored with the Secret Service Valor Award for your part in helping hundreds of people to safety. Do you recognize that mood of vengeance that we get after Lincoln's assassination? How did people feel after 9/11?
After September 11th, a lot of people were very angry. And people want immediate vengeance. That's correct. You have to be careful with something like that because you don't want vengeance. You want justice. Those are not the same things. When you are focused on vengeance, you're going to make mistakes. So you have to be very careful. If my focus is Mary's a conspirator, I'm not coming into the investigation objectively. I'm coming in saying, I know you already did it. You are already guilty in my mind. And that is very, very dangerous because it means that I am only going to focus and pay attention to the things that make you appear guilty to me.
Now, Evie, I am interested in the sort of gendered language that was used at Mary Surratt's trial. Listen to this. She was portrayed by the tribunal as the nurturer of the plot. They called her the keeper of the nest that hatched the egg. What do you think about that?
This is something that had never been seen before, a woman to do such a thing and to be part of something so horrible, right? I think what they did was very clever. They created a narrative. They used her gender as part of it. It's actually quite brilliant how it was portrayed, and it worked.
But I do have this slightly nagging feeling that she was singled out for breaking out of the domestic sphere and getting involved in conflict, in politics. Evie, do you think that there's still a feeling in society today that women should put on their aprons and stay in the kitchen?
It depends. The career that I went into, for example, it definitely ruffled quite a few feathers. I think maybe in some ways people looked at me a little bit crazy. Like, why would you want to do this? What are you thinking? And as a woman, you just have to make sure that you can actually do what you say you're going to do and what's expected of you.
Let's see what happens next. The verdict comes in. All eight of them are found guilty. There were four prison sentences and four death sentences handed out. Now, Mary's female, which suggests she's going to get prison rather than death, doesn't it? She is informed of her fate in her prison cell.
The commission sentences Mary E. Surratt to be hanged by the neck until she be dead.
Mary is completely unprepared for this. She screams, she sobs, she collapses on the floor of her cell. Throughout the night, Mary's lawyers and her daughter Anna desperately pursue every legal avenue to try to get her sentence commuted, delayed, appealed, on the basis of Mary's age and gender. Anna pleads for an audience with President Johnson, but it's in vain. He orders that the executions go ahead the following day, the 7th of July, 1865. It's an unbearably hot, humid day in Washington, D.C. the four condemned prisoners to listen to the scaffold being built and the drop tested. But even the hangman thinks that a last-minute reprieve must be on its way. With this in mind, he delays proceedings for 4 hours. In the end, though, Mary Surratt is hanged with her three fellow conspirators at 1:22 p.m. She is the first white woman to be executed by the United States government. Evie, the Department of War commissioned a photographer to document the executions. We've got them here, and they are very disturbing to look at. There's something so unbelievably horrible and distressing about seeing the dark dress of a woman. That is Mary Surratt hanging there. And it seems to me that this was done so that people will be able to witness her punishment, if you like. But it also seems to me that this backfired as a tactic. There was revulsion. The public mood changed towards Mary Surratt. For many people, she became a martyr. She was a mother. She was murdered. Do you have my feeling, Evie, that this was a government who went too far in their thirst for vengeance?
They definitely rushed towards the execution. Today, if somebody's put on death row, it takes a very long time. So to have a verdict and to do it the next day, it's extremely rushed. And I do think that that backfired on them. I think if they had taken their time to verify certain things and to show people that, hey, we really looked at this, we exhausted this, this is someone who did conspire, we know this for sure to be true. But their haste and their rush, and it came off as, bringing that word back again, vengeance rather than justice.
So interesting. Now, I'm keen to explore the legacy of Mary Surratt's crime. I asked Nikki Taylor to go to the Surratt Tavern in Maryland, about 20 miles from Washington, D.C. It's the place where John Wilkes Booth came to pick up supplies after shooting the president. And it's now a museum run by the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission. Nikki's latest book is about the lethal resistance of enslaved women. So she was particularly keen to find out about the enslaved people held by Mary Surratt.
I'm here with Veronica Gallardo, the director of the Surratt House Museum, and also with Logan Wills Elizondo, who's one of the museum interpreters. So let me describe the house. It's a two-story farmhouse. And what really struck me is that there are 10 rooms, which means it says a lot about the wealth of this family at the time that they built it. Veronica, this museum has focused on the history of Mary Surratt, including the role of the place in the conspiracy for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. But with your leadership, it started to take on a new focus.
So today, we are addressing the previous racist interpretation of the house. We will utilize this site and its resources for a more honest interpretation of the legacy of the American Civil War and how it still impacts us today. Specifically regarding the history of enslavement, the Surratts enslaved at least 8 individuals here, about 15 over the course of their lives.
And as a historian of African American history, of course, I'm intrigued with your new focus on this. And it's just shocking that that's part of her legacy. A lot of her wealth was also tied to the enslaved people she owned, right?
We do know that the Surratts did rent. Also, they were enslaved people that were rented to them. Rachel Hawkins, she was the enslaved chef. She would have been rented here for a period of about 6 years before emancipation. She would have been doing most of the cooking and cleaning for not just the family, but anybody else in this place. People eating in the tavern, sleeping in the boarding rooms. I would have been doing quite a lot of very difficult work along with a couple of the other enslaved women here.
So I'm really interested in the repercussions of Abraham Lincoln's assassination, especially for African Americans. As you both know, too many people in Maryland and beyond were unwilling to imagine an America that fully integrated African Americans. And so we're still in the process, even today, still trying to obtain the promises of the U.S. Constitution the promises of the American Revolution on behalf of African Americans for civil rights and justice today.
We really want to address the impact of Lincoln's death and sharing those stories and that history to our visitors so we can actually take some action ourselves to address the legacy of white supremacy, which I believe the Surratt family represented. We can have conversations about these topics that society would be better off.
And finally, bearing in mind the tortured legacy of Mary Surratt, how do you think she should be remembered?
She should be remembered for who and what she was, an enslaver, a Confederate sympathizer, and a traitor. But her memory shouldn't be the only one, nor is the most important one at this museum.
That is very powerful. Very powerful.
That really gives a sense of the scale of the consequences of what Mary Surratt did in killing Lincoln. Evie, what do you take from the story of Mary Surratt?
I was amazed. And I think don't stereotype people because you don't know what somebody is capable of.
I've just been thinking what I've learned from you today. You've talked a lot about not using stereotypes and not making assumptions. You've completely made me question some of my own assumptions today. To me, there's something pleasingly countercultural about Mary Surratt's venturing into a man's world and undermining the domestic image of Victorian womanhood. And I suspect that that really got under the skin of her prosecutors. Mary Surratt's case has a chilling resonance today, I think, because it reminds us of the all-too-present danger of political violence in a deeply divided American nation. I can't feel much sympathy for Mary. She was a slaveholder, and her death really stems from her refusal to accept the ending of slavery. And Lincoln's assassination has had this awful legacy for African Americans, for whom it swept away hopes of freedom and equality. And that's something that still echoes today. Well, a huge thank you to Evie Pomperas, Nikki Taylor, Alex Wood, Veronica Gallardo, and Logan Wills Elizondo. Next time on Lady Killers, we head to a lonely farm in Devon, where a young servant is found dead in her bed. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Bill Hope, Jonathan Keeble, and Lauren Lefko. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Hayball. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. If you want to know even more about how we bring these fascinating stories to life for this podcast, you can join Roz and I for an exclusive behind-the-scenes chat about what it takes to make Lady Killers. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.